I'd like to call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but we have kind of a heavy agenda, and we'll officially call the meeting to order when we get a quorum. So, Mr. Hutchins, if we interrupt you for that, excuse us. There are some announcements we'll make when more people are here as well, but I think things are in your packet. We're pleased that today to have with us Peter Hutchinson, the former Commissioner of Finance for the state of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, and we'll have also, in addition to the agenda, John Dunyu, another former commissioner as well, and will give us some testimony and some different ideas. Purpose of the meeting today is to be able to have committee members and others have some perspective on alternatives to our traditional budgeting ways. We may want to take a look at them. I know sometimes I've heard Peter before, and there's been some academic realities to this and some practical realities, but I think it's important for all of us to be able to step back, take a look at some other opportunities we may have in budgeting. So welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate that. And excuse the interruptions as may happen as people come in.
Hi, my name is Peter Hutchinson. I'm a lot of former things. I spent 14 years at what was then the Dayton Hudson Corporation. Then became Commissioner of Finance under Rudy Perpich. Left that on election, right after the election, started a company called the Public Strategies Group, which engages with governments around the country, in fact, around the world, in changing the way they do business in order to get, as we like to say, better results for citizens at a competitive price. In the course of that, I served as the superintendent of schools in Minneapolis from 1993 to 97. Have been engaged in this work that I'm about to describe to you for about the last 10 years, having implemented alternative budget systems in jurisdictions of all kinds across the country. And as you probably recall, I also took a swing at running for governor last year. So in some ways, I view that as a 19-month focus group around Minnesota, and learned a ton and appreciate more than ever what you all do. Here are the points I want to make this morning. I think you have handouts of all this stuff, at least I hope you do. First, that there is a price of government. There's an amount of money that citizens are willing to pay. And not only is there one, but over time, we've figured out what it is. It's like the set point on a thermostat, and I'll show you that in just a second. Secondly, the Minnesotans expect a better deal. The price of government has been going up over the last 4 or 5 years, but the results of government have not. And that's not a good deal. Higher prices, same or worse results, that's not a good deal, and citizens don't like that. This legislature and governor are in a very unique position to get them a better deal, one that we haven't seen for a long time. I want to visit with you about that opportunity, talk about how you could use the budget process to make that happen, and then describe a set of recommendations for moving forward. Let's start with this notion of the price of government. When we talk about this, at least for today, what I'd invite you to do is think of the price of government as all the taxes, all the fees, all the charges, all the fines, all the assessments, all the parking revenues, everything. All the money government collects from whatever source. So not just taxes. All the money government collects as a percentage of income. But if you add it all up, if you took all the money collected by all the governments in the country and divided it by the personal income of all the people in the country, that'd be the price of government. That's the percentage of our income that we turn over to government every year, or think of it as the number of cents per dollar that we pay as a price for government in our country. Well, here's what it is in the United States. For the last, this goes back to 1972, so for the last 32 years or so. And what I invite you to look at is not the level of this line, but its shape. It is, in fact, as though there were a thermostat at work with a set point. In this case, the set point is 36 cents. 36 cents out of every dollar of income has been going to government When you take all the government, the millions of governments and the millions of decisions made every year across the country for 32 years, on average it's 36%, 36 cents, $36 out of 100, however you want to put it. Good years, bad years, liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, it's 36. When it gets too hot, we want tax cuts. And if you look at the right-hand side of this graph, you can see what happened when Clinton and Gingrich got together and decided to eliminate the deficit. They did it with a very large tax increase. And the price of government rose to its highest level in history in about the year 2000. And you remember the 2000 election, we had Gore and Bush, and they disagreed on everything under the sun except one thing. Everybody agreed we needed a massive tax cut, and we got it. You may not like the tax cut. You may think it went too far. You may think it didn't go far enough. But it reduced the price of government significantly. Got it right back down. Actually, got it below the set point. And over the last 4 years, the price of government has been rising again. And today, it is at almost exactly at 36. There's a set point. There's a price of government we're willing to pay. Now, you all know that this price is not in law. It's not in the Constitution. It's not anywhere. This is the consequence of a whole collection of decisions made by legislatures like yours, by city councils, county boards, school boards, the federal government. Over a long period of time in our country, we've settled out at 36. Now, this isn't true everywhere. Europe has a higher price of government. South America has a lower price of government. We don't even know what the price of government is in China. But every place has one, including Minnesota. Now, the reason that the perspective I want you to have on this is that if there's a price of government, there's also a price for housing and food and clothing and shelter and education and so on and so forth. I mean, the point of this exercise was, when I started it, to try to understand how citizens are using their money. And if they're paying 36% or so for government, what are they paying for other stuff? Well, this graph shows you this. Housing is the top line. You can look at the graph and see what's going on. What I want to point out here is that if the price of government has a set point to it, interestingly enough, not everything else does. Housing seems to. Housing is about 20% and has been for the same period of time. But if you look at clothing or food or transportation, the price of those, the share of income going to those things has been falling. And then look at health care. The price of health care to the average American has more or less tripled in the last 30 years. How have they paid for that? Well, we needed the reduction in the price of clothing, the price of housing, the price of transportation. We also took it out of savings. But what I think is a miracle, frankly, is that with all the pressures on family budgets and all the pressures on the economy from health care, that the price of government has stayed so stable for so many years. Citizens have sorted this out other ways, by demanding more from other parts of the economy in many ways than they have from government. So my takeaway from all this is there's only 100%. Citizens have been willing to commit 36% of that to government. Our job is to figure out how to use that 36 as effectively as we can. Now, what's true for government as a whole is also true in Minnesota. Here's that federal that total government line at the top again that I showed you just a second ago, and below it is the Minnesota line. Minnesota has a price of government. This is the sum total of all the taxes, fees, charges, assessments, fines, tuition, and everything else from governments in Minnesota. And the set point here is 16.5. Sometimes higher, sometimes lower, but the set point is about 16.5. We've sort of settled out in Minnesota on a price of government at 16.5. It's above average. The average for the country is about 15. We're a high-priced state. That doesn't come as a shock to anybody in this room. We're not the highest price. New York is about 17. We're certainly not the lowest. We have places like New Hampshire down around 12. But our 16.5 is ours. It's the price we sorted out and settled on through whatever mechanisms are at work out there. We've been willing as a state and as a governmental community to commit that much of our income. Again, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. When the price gets too high, when the thermostat gets turned up too much, when the heat is on, citizens want to see that price brought back down to average. When it gets below average, there's a way in which it works its way back up. And if you just think about the last 6 or 7 years here in Minnesota, you can see this whole thing played out. back in 2000, we had a very high price of government relative to the 16 and a half. It was over 17. And you all remember, many of you will remember, back in 1999 and 2000, we were cutting, we were rebating, we were actively reducing the price of government. We passed a very big tax cut that drove the price of government down. So that in the year 2002, the price of government in Minnesota got all the way down to 15.4, way below the set point. Now you also know we've had a no new taxes policy in the executive branch for the last 4 years. And while we've had that no new taxes policy in place, the price of government in Minnesota has gone from 15.4 to 16.5. So with no new taxes, the price of government nevertheless found its way back to the set point. How did that happen? Well, you know. There was no new taxes at the state level. Property taxes went up. Fees went up. Assessments went up. Charges went up. Tuition went up. You got back to the set point. Again, my point here is that there is a price of government, and that we can see what it is. And I want to urge you to, as you think about budgeting, to accept this reality that we've decided in Minnesota in our own way what the prices we're willing to pay. We can have a roaring argument, and I'm not going to try to have it today, about how to collect the price of government, who should pay it and through what mechanism. But what I want to argue is there is one, and it's what citizens are willing to pay for their government. So the challenge for us is to get them the best possible deal we can for the price they're willing to pay. And this leads to this second important point. In the last 4 or 5 years, the price of government in Minnesota has gone up from 15.4 to now 16.5. It's back to the set point. But if you think about what's happened in that same time period, healthcare costs have risen, more people are uninsured, more people have been pushed out on their own in healthcare. Only 25% of our ninth graders end up with a college degree, and 36% of our college freshmen are taking remedial courses. Our roads are the worst they've been in 20 years. And we've got 10,000 polluted waters in Minnesota. We're paying the same price, but we're not getting the same deal. I think our challenge is, your challenge as public officials, you won the elections, my challenge as an instigator, is to keep pushing away at this question of how can we get a better deal for our citizens for the price that they're willing to pay. And you're in a unique position this year to actually get them a better deal. First of all, you got $1 billion surplus, a real live surplus. You've got money you can invest in the future of Minnesota. This is something we haven't had in a long time. But you've also got a big pile of operating revenue that you get to think about as well. You got roughly $17 billion a year in general fund revenues. By the way, only $500 million of which is not already spoken for in the forecast. You've got another $4 billion of other state revenues. There's $13 billion of local government revenues, schools, counties, cities, special districts, and so on, and $8 billion of federal revenue. That's a lot of resource that the citizens have committed and would like to get a better deal. Now, one of your challenges, I think, is to decide what to do about all of those resources, if anything. And traditionally, in this process, you focus most exclusively on the general fund. And I want to invite you at least to think about all the other pieces of the price of government that our citizens pay. Because if you focus only on the general fund, you're really focusing only on about half of what is paid for government services. And it's hard to get the best deal for citizens if you're only thinking about half of the resources. So the first question is, can you think about the rest, and how might you think about them? And in this unique opportunity that you've got, it just strikes me that these are the sorts of questions that you get to ask this year. How do we best use that surplus to leverage what we do for better results over the long run? What investments would make the most sense for Minnesota if we were going to use that one-time money? How can we get the most from every dollar in the general fund, not just focus on the part that's not already committed to something? How can we link the other state funds to results that we really care about in Minnesota? How can you influence what goes on at the local level with that other $13 billion that's out there? And then how do we leverage the federal dollars that are going to come to our state, mostly, as you know, for human service-related programs? Well, what I want to argue is that the way we traditionally budget isn't going to get us there. Those are the kind of questions we want to wrestle with. This is Einstein. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I've been engaged with budgeting not nearly as long as some of you, but a long time, and we always do it the same way, and we always get the same result. We always end up with people frustrated, with people blaming one another, and citizens wondering, when are they going to get a better deal? And that's because most budgeting in the public sector focuses on the cost of the status quo. In most budgets, we start by asking the question, how much will it cost to keep doing what we've been doing in the way we've been doing it? And the answer is always the same. It's going to cost more. Just to keep the status quo, if we change nothing, we'll cost more. We've got to pay increased salaries. We've got to pay increased health benefits. Asphalt costs more. Gasoline, paper, travel, complexity, whatever it is, it always ends up costing more. And because those costs rise faster than our revenues, by and large, we always end up budgeting by cutting. It's always not about what we're going to do, but what we're going to cut. We always focus on what we have to not do, what we're forced to live without, as opposed to focusing on what we are going to do. And in this system, and you know this as base budgeting, by and large, the base rarely, if ever, gets seriously examined. So we end up doing what we've done historically and then tweak it at the margin. And when you do it this way, you really end up, well, with the status quo, but only less. I remember when I was commissioner, going through this whole process of people asking for a lot more money than we had, and I said to one agency, well, we'll get you a 6% increase, and because they had expected 10%, they accused me of cutting them 4%. Well, it's that kind of logic that defies common sense, and it's very difficult to explain to our citizens how getting 6% more can be bad news. But it is bad news if your focus is on how much it costs to maintain the status quo. And if that's the focus of our budget, which it tends to be, it makes it difficult for us to get out of it. Now, why do we have these persistent cost pressures? This is real quick. And the short answer is healthcare. If you look at this graph, this is from the Congressional Budget Office, you can see that the price of the federal government is about 18 cents, plus or minus a little bit. And within a few years, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security are going to eat up the entire federal budget. Well, that's why federal aid is being cut. That's why every single time the Congress meets, they have to make this choice between cutting programs and deficit spending. And they're always going to choose deficit spending because they don't really want to cut, but the cost of health care is going to kill them. And just notice on here, it is health care, not Social Security, that is the core problem. We had this roaring debate for 10 years about Social Security. We should be having a roaring debate about the future of Medicare because it is going to bankrupt the federal government, and we're, at the state and local level, going to experience the consequences. But it's just as true in state and local government. This is all state and local governments across the country, not just Minnesota, but you can see by looking quickly at this chart that everything but prisons and health care are being cut in order to make room for prisons and health care across the country. And this is a crisis that's not about to ebb unless we intervene much more aggressively in the cost of health care and the way we pay for health care. We're feeling these same pressures here in Minnesota as education and higher education, transportation, human services, everything is forced to give way in order to finance the rising cost of the status quo in health care. And that's an impossible vice that we all find ourselves in. And so, but we do play this old budget game over and over and over. And the old budget game is categorized by focusing on agencies. It's fundamentally about budgeting for organizations, not budgeting for outcomes. And generally speaking, we focus on the general fund. We pay for costs. In fact, the budget is built up by asking people how much would it cost to keep doing what we've been doing. And we end up playing hide-and-go-seek, what I call spam in a can budgeting. A spam here is the old concept of spam. Some of you will even remember taking spam out of the can. Have you ever done that? You know, it's covered by a disgusting gelatinous material. Think of that as an agency budget submission. It's incredibly difficult to cut. Incredibly difficult. When I was commissioner and we needed a 5% reduction from the Department of Natural Resources, they told me I had two choices. Choice A, close Itasca State Park. Choice B, close all the bathrooms in all the state parks. That's spam in a can budgeting. That's not getting our citizens a better deal. That's just making it very difficult for me as a commissioner, for you as legislators, to find a budget solution. So it becomes an all-cuts, all-blame, all-the-time approach to budgeting, in which your job in particular, I think, is made most difficult, because when you do make a decision, you're just going to get blamed for it. Somebody is going to come to you and say, you cut me, and therefore you're a bad, evil, nasty person. And so you want to avoid that. And, of course, the governors want to avoid that, and so we resort to these things at the bottom part of the slide in yellow, not by accident, by the way. We steal funds from one account and put them in another account to make the one account look better. And since we only focus on the general fund, if we steal money from the other funds, it doesn't look like we did anything bad. We lie in accounting about spending and revenue, and we do this. We tell the retailers to send in their June sales tax receipts in June, when they normally send them in July, and that just brings revenue into this year, makes it look as though we got more money, but we didn't get any more. Or we delay school-age spending into the next fiscal year. We just push this stuff around and claim that we've done something. We borrow. The most pernicious form of borrowing is not the straight-up borrowing that some states do. It's the deferred maintenance. It's simply not spending money we know we need to spend, thinking that whoever's around 5 years from now, they'll figure it out. Well, the 5 years eventually comes, and that money that we stole from the future then becomes due. We use reserves, we sell off assets, we pass the bill, the buck, and the blame to somebody else. Local government people can tell you a lot about what that feels like. Or we do across-the-board cuts, we thin the soup, because after all, anybody can handle a 4% reduction. Well, you do thinning the soup long enough, and pretty soon there's nothing left. And it's not a way to make a better deal for citizens, it just makes the budget look better. Well, I want to argue there's a different way. And it has these four key elements. The first is to set the price of government at the outset. To say today, how much money are we going to spend on government in Minnesota? Not at the end of the process, but at the beginning. Then to talk turkey with citizens about what it is we think we can deliver. What are the results that citizens really want to get from our government? What are our priorities? Then thirdly, how can we get leverage? Where are the ways in which we can spend money the most effectively to get better outcomes, and who can do it best and at the best price? If we put a budget together around these four questions, we'd be able to deliver, with the price that citizens are willing to pay, a lot better outcome. And here's what it would take. First, you establish the price. Then you define the results that citizens want. You treat budget submissions, whether it's from state agencies, local governments, and even nonprofit organizations, as offers to deliver those results at a price. You get as many offers as you can for each result, as many good ideas as possible from whoever has good ideas. You measure and rank those offers against the results that you wanted to achieve in the first place, and then buy the best ones. Keep the good stuff and leave the rest. So that in the end, what you've done is put that price that citizens are willing to pay against those proposals that make the most sense, regardless of where they came from, regardless of who put them on the table. You end up getting the most result for the money. As I mentioned, we've done this in a lot of places. Here's a quick list. I'm going to highlight Michigan today, but I do want to point out that Hutchinson, Minnesota is on this list. And they've only begun this year. We'll see how it comes out, but I'm proud that it's in Minnesota and thrilled that Hutchinson happens to be the place. I want to highlight Michigan, though, because in Michigan, something very different happened. In all of these other locales, this process was initiated by the executive. In Michigan, it was initiated by the legislature. The legislature said in, I think it was 2002, we want to think about our budget differently. It was 2004, actually. We want to think about our budget differently. We know the governor's going to send us a budget, but we want to think about that budget differently. And so the House, as a matter of fact, in Michigan chose to do what we call budgeting for outcomes, hence the acronym BFO. Just so you know the politics of the situation, the governor of Michigan at the time and today is a Democrat. Both houses of the legislature at that time were controlled by the Republicans.
Can I just interrupt a second? We do have a quorum. I would like to call the meeting officially before us, and that would be the end of the interruption. We keep going.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to put this in context, the House caucus, the House Republican caucus, the majority caucus, got together, and they decided that when the governor's budget came in, they wanted to subject it to this kind of analysis, to this kind of approach. And so they did these things. First, they established the overall price, how much they thought ought to be spent on government in Michigan in that fiscal year, and the priority results. Now, there's a lot more detail here that I won't go into, but they established those results by doing a series of focus groups around the state with just average citizens. So they had in their minds how much they were going to spend and what results they wanted to deliver. Then they created a committee. They kind of restructured their committees a bit. This was a temporary restructuring for each result. So they had, I think they had 9 results they had in mind: improving the health of Michiganders, improving educational outcomes, improving mobility, and so on. They created a committee for each one of those results and charged that committee to define the result, figure out where the leverage was, look around the country to discover best practice, and actually, as a matter of policy, establish what the state strategy ought to be. In education, for example, should small class sizes be the fundamental strategy or improved curriculum? To make some fundamental strategic choices about how to go about achieving those results. Then when the budget came over from the governor, which was organized in the traditional agency-based approach, they deconstructed that budget. They took it apart and put it back together based on results. And they discovered something that all jurisdictions that have gone through this have discovered. Take health care, for example. The health department budget does not constitute all the spending that goes on in government related to health care. Right? There's a lot of spending in the K-12 system that deals with health care. There's a lot of spending in the corrections system that deals with health care. There's health care related spending all across the budget. What they did is they recast the budget based on the results, not based on the organization structure of the government. And when they did this, they discovered overlaps, redundancies, people trying to do the same thing, some people doing it better, some people doing it worse. The whole idea was to look at the result, not so much on the who was doing it. Once they got that deconstructed, I think they ended up with 900 parts reorganized into these results categories. They then added or amended proposals based on what they had developed in their strategy or best practices they'd seen around the country. Then they ranked them. And they once they had their ranked list, at the top of the list were the proposals, the approaches, the activities that produced the most for citizens for the money. At the bottom were the things that produced the least. They knew how much money they had to spend because they had made that decision at the beginning. They worked their way down the list till they ran out of money. They drew a line. Above the line was the stuff that they chose to keep. Below the line was the stuff they chose not to keep. In the end, the agency budgets then were recompiled based on what was kept. Agencies actually discovered what they were going to do in the next fiscal year when they discovered which of their activities, which of their proposals, the legislature had chosen to purchase. This is a little diagram they used to make this clear. You rank order everything, and you draw the line at the point where you've run out of money. And sure, there's stuff below the line you would like to do, but you can't spend more than what you got. You can't spend beyond the price that you established at the very beginning. Now, just so there's full disclosure about this, this was the House. The Senate in Michigan chose to go a different way. And so at the end of this process, of course, you still had the three players in a room. The majority leader and speaker in the House, the majority leader in the Senate, and the governor sorting the whole thing out. The difference for the House, at least, was their set of decisions were based on clarity about the price, clarity about the results, and clarity about which things contributed the most to the outcome. And for the others, they had to make the case to the House members that taking something from below the line was a better expenditure of citizen funds than the stuff that was above the line. And that was a tough debate. There were some of those decisions that were made. This is a political environment, after all. But the fundamental character of the budget was changed by focusing attention on outcomes, not just on agencies. The final result was a balanced budget because you start with the money you've got, not the money you wish you had. You focus on the keeps, not the cuts. The focus is on what are we going to deliver for citizens, not what are we not going to do. You buy results, not costs of the status quo. One interesting, and I think the powerful part about doing it this way, if every one of the offers from an agency or a local government or a nonprofit is really an offer to deliver a result at a price, you've got a performance deal in the making. You don't have to go back and say, what is it we thought we were going to get? You should know it on the front end, because every one of these offers actually does represent, I'll deliver this much outcome at this price, over this time frame. And when the time comes to do the budget the next time, you can step back and say, hey, you made us a deal last year. Did you live up to it? Did you deliver what you said? Did it cost what you say? And did you get it done on time? A lot of energy goes into continuously improving. Just one side story. In another jurisdiction where we implemented this approach, the offers came in. This was a county. The offers came in from the departments. And what the committees did is they ranked all these offers based on their contribution to the outcome. And they published the ranking before they made any decisions. They published the ranking. And then they said to the agencies or the department heads, if you want to amend any of your proposals, you can do it now. Now remember, they're looking at the list. They're seeing what order things are in. The people at the bottom of the list are saying to themselves, of course I want to amend my proposal. I got to get myself up the list. And the people just ahead of them said, well, if they're going to change their proposal, I want to change mine. By the time it was done, 85% of the proposals were resubmitted. And the result was the county got a lot more for its money because of having challenged all the agencies to deliver more and more and more for what the citizens wanted. So what should Minnesota do? First, I think we ought to accept what Minnesotans seem to have decided on, that 16.5 is the price we're willing to pay for government. And we should focus our attention on how to get the most for their money, all of their money. Again, not just the general fund, but all the funds, and not just state funds, but state, local, and federal. Most citizens think of it as government. They don't think about how government is organized. And they just want the results that matter most to them. And that's the second thing. As a legislature, and ultimately the governor, we should actually have a conversation about what are the results citizens really want from our government. And knowing that, we should look for the points of leverage. We should look to see how we can get the most for the money. What do we know from other jurisdictions? Maybe even other countries. What do we know that works and what do we know that doesn't work? And finally, we can't forget in the debate about the budget the role of personal responsibility in actually delivering outcomes that citizens value. It's not just government that does it. It's government as a way of coalescing citizen engagement, but if the citizens don't do their part, it doesn't work. Thirdly, use the surplus to invest. Now, I use the word invest in its old traditional sense, not as a code word for spending more money. Invest to me means you create an asset that's going to deliver something for you over time. It's one-time money. You have a unique opportunity to think about how to use this very substantial amount of money. Would it be better to invest this money in changing our healthcare system so it costs less and delivers more later on? Would it be better to invest this money in paying down outstanding highway debt so that we can better finance long-term improvements of our highway assets? Would it be better to invest this money in an endowment to provide scholarships for our kids so the cost of higher ed wouldn't be quite so onerous? Or would it be better to just give the money back to our citizens and let them use it? Those are really important policy decisions that you all get to make. And I urge you to make it for the whole billion, not just sort of one little piece at a time. So that at the end you can say to citizens, these are the investment decisions we made separate from our spending decisions. When it comes to spending, recognize that the budget, reorganize the budget, and do it by result. Think about the outcomes, not just the organizations. Don't feel obliged to fund XYZ agency. Feel obliged to figure out how to get more and better health care or more better education or more and better mobility for our citizens. Invite local governments to be part of this process explicitly. Not as folks coming in as supplicants asking you for help, but as people who are responsible for making the same kind of fundamental purchasing decisions with a huge portion of the price that citizens pay for government. Pay for results, not for programs. Don't ever again feel obliged to give someone an inflationary increase if you don't know what we're going to get in return in terms of results for our citizens. I hope that you'll even consider organizing the legislature differently so that it focuses more on results and less on organizations. And finally, encourage competition in the best sense. Encourage people to come forward with their best ideas, maybe even their craziest ideas. But use the generation of ideas as an opportunity to find better ways to do the public's work for the public's benefit. The bottom line is this: Minnesotans deserve and can get a better deal. You're in a unique position to help them get it this year. It's a position that probably isn't going to repeat itself for a long time. And my invitation to you is to take full advantage of this opportunity to show Minnesotans how good things actually could be. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hutchinson, thank you very much. We have about 5 minutes that we can have for questions, and Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Hutchinson a little bit about the relationship then of the state legislature, the state, and the other governing bodies. And I was sitting here listening to you, and I think commitment to focus at the University of Minnesota was about the time you were commissioner, maybe not directly involved, but it would have appeared that from the legislative perspective we were making a base adjustment for the university, yet there was a lot of dialogue with the university about their internal reallocations that they happened at that point in time called the commitment to focus. You're a former superintendent. Both of us are interested in education, the role of the local school board. You know, we adjust the foundation aid formula, but we have certain expectations that the local governing boards, school boards, city councils know what's best to meet the needs of their community. So if you could comment on that relationship and what our role should be.
To me, I think of it as two parts. I think from the point of view of the state and the use of state resources, your job is to try to define the outcomes that our state citizens want from these publicly supported institutions. If we're going to take statewide resources to support the U or MNSCU or our K-12 systems, I think the state ought to try to articulate as clearly as they can for those organizations what is it we expect? What, not how to run them, but what do we expect? We expect kids to graduate in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 12 years? Do we expect kids to learn how to read by third grade, fourth grade, sixth grade? What are our expectations in terms of the outcomes we want to see from our institutions and organizations? The role of the university or MNSCU or the local school board then is to figure out how to deliver on those expectations, to get the job done. And that's why I want to suggest to you that we could improve and enhance both of these jobs if we would invite them to offer you their best ideas about how to get it done. Not what to get done, but how to get it done. And if they've got a better idea, a better way, a change in structure, a change in operation, a change in approach that would do a better job for more kids, we ought to want to support that if it's going to get us a better outcome. But it's not the case, and you and I both have been in local public education in particular, that we want to invite the state to get involved in, directly in the operating decisions of these local organizations. The state's never going to know enough to do a better job than the local folks. So I think the state's job is to set the bar, and the job of local officials and local organizations is to figure out how to get there and to try to be as effective and creative and to demand as much from themselves as our taxpayers would demand from us.
Other questions? Representative Stumper.
Chairman Silver, Mr. Hutchinson, you made the statement here just a little bit ago that Minnesotans have decided that the price of government they want to pay is $16.50. I believe you said something like that, didn't you? Who decided that? When was that decided? How was that decided?
It's been decided over the last 30-plus years through elections, through appropriation decisions, through decisions to raise assessments and fees and fines and taxes and everything else. And if you just look back over the last 30-plus years, what you discover is that when the price of government gets above 16.5, citizens lean on us in a very particular way. If it gets too far above 16.5, they actually elect different people, and we bring the price down. Or if it gets too low, citizens start arguing just the opposite, and they work in a direction that brings it right back up. And over the last 34 years or so, on average, we've been at 16.5. We may have wished otherwise. People may have actually argued otherwise. But the facts on the ground are we're 16.5% state. That's who we've been. And there's nothing to suggest, including the last 6 to 10 years, nothing to suggest that we're moving off that. We had, as I said earlier, we had the no new tax. We still have the no new taxes regime, I guess. But we went in the last 4 years from 15.4 to 16.5. Now, that happened because the people of Minnesota demanded more from their government, and they were willing to pay for it. They just did it through means other than taxes. And so fees and charges and assessments and tuition and property taxes all got raised. And we're right back at 16.5 right now. And my argument to people on both sides of the aisle is that's it. Those who want to spend more are already spending more. And those who want to spend less, forget it. It's not going to happen. We're a 16.5% state. Let's focus our attention not on whether we like that number, but how to use that number as effectively as possible.
Mr. Hutchinson, our staff is, and the finance department has put that particular document out and forecasted in the future as well. And I'll have them reproduce that and share it with you. But in 2006, it's forecasted 16.5, and it goes down then to 15.9 in 2011 as a forecast
under current law. Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting.
And to compliment our state, because you know I love Minnesota, we're the only state in the union that calculates this, and we're the only state in the union that has this calculation in law.
Well, one of the difficult things of the calculation is sometimes what to include it in the calculation. And a municipal golf course is included in the calculation, and a private golf course is not included in the calculation. So sometimes there's a debate on what we should have considered as the price of government, per se. Any other quick questions for, yes, Representative Feiner?
Chair Solberg, Mr. Hutchinson. My concern is a follow-up on Representative Carlson's discussion of the relationship between state and local government. Having served in both capacities, I'm not quite comfortable with your identification of the state's role as setting the bar and local government's role in delivering the results. I believe, for instance, school districts are called in our state independent school districts for a reason, and that's that local citizens want to be involved in setting that bar, and districts do set different bars. Because I think city governments and county governments do this also in dialogue with their constituents, because local ownership is very important in terms of setting those objectives in order to get the results. So I'm not totally comfortable with handing over to the state the goal of setting all results.
I think it's open for debate. I think it's a debate worth having. My perspective is this. For most citizens, not the ones that show up at the city council meetings, not the ones that come to the school board meetings, for most citizens, it's government. They don't sit around. They don't even know where the boundaries are for most of these places. They don't attend the meetings. They just pay the taxes, the fines, the fees, the assessments, and so on. And what they want is results. They want to feel safe in their homes. They want to be able to get where they want to go. They want kids to get a good education. They want the university system to function. They don't think about these, which are important to local elected officials, but they don't think about these distinctions. It's all government to them, and it's all government taking their money. And so they expect somebody to focus attention on whether or not government's delivering. And in our system, especially with the, we have such a highly integrated state-local relationship in this state, the state is in the best position on behalf of citizens as a whole, not just citizens of one jurisdiction, but citizens as a whole in Minnesota, the state's in the best position to talk about where it is we're trying to go. Whether, you know, if the state, I agree, if the state said we don't care whether or not kids learn how to read, well, the state has no business setting that as the bar. But the state wouldn't do that, I don't believe. I don't think there's anything to suggest that a local jurisdiction couldn't set the bar higher. But when the people of one part of the state are in effect paying for services in another part of the state, they expect that there's going to be at least a minimum return on that spending. And they get concerned when they don't see it, and they don't experience it, and they don't think other people are worrying about it. So I do think the state has a very important job on behalf of citizens as a whole to articulate where we're trying to get to without interfering with the local prerogative to either get further or do better or do it smarter. And as we do that, one of the beauties of the American system, at least, is if a local jurisdiction figures out a better way to do this, part of our job is to see to it that everybody knows about it and see if we can't just keep raising the bar for everyone. And again, getting more result for our citizens for every dollar that they spend and we spend on their behalf.
I'm going to have to cut off the time for Peter Hutchinson. Thank you very much. We have a couple of other questions involved, and maybe what you could do is, if in an academic setting of some type, is give us a paper on how we rein in those health care costs and the prison costs that are continuing to go up. And also, it would be interesting to have some discussion on the federal decision on deficit spending and what the long-term goals of those and results would be. But, Mr. Hutchinson, thank you very much for your service, and thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
There's a couple of bookkeeping things that we need to do. I'm sure Representative Gunther has read the minutes, and Representative Gunther moves approval of the minutes of 1-8. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed and carried. A couple of announcements first. In your package, you have the agenda. Next Thursday, I think at 5:30, we will be receiving formally the governor's proposal budget from Commissioner Hansen. I think it's at 5:30 in the evening. The governor is presenting his budget today, but we'll have an opportunity then to have a little bit more detailed discussion of what the governor is proposing. I think it's at 5:30 on Thursday. Is that correct? And then the other thing is on January 29th, we will be having a hearing. We're traveling up to Isanti to have an opportunity to have the citizens talk to us. There'll be more information coming out and when the buses leave and so forth. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your agenda shows 10:30 or immediately following session, and I believe the last email stated that session was going to be short on Thursday and that you were meeting in midday as opposed to 5:30, so I guess I'm a little confused.
So am I. I think it's 10:30. Thank you for the staff just corrected me. So I appreciate that. I think that's the thing. Well, check your emails for make sure that it's correct. Staff will keep me correct on it. Okay? Other questions? Then we have the pleasure to have another former commissioner, Mr. Gagne. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Gagne. I'm currently the I'm currently the city manager in Minnetonka, and was formerly the finance commissioner under Governor Arne Carlson. And I, as Mr. Hutchinson, I appreciate the opportunity to be here to offer some thoughts as you start the budget debate. I understand the governor is releasing the budget later today publicly, and then with the February forecast update, the debate will begin in earnest. I always enjoyed House Speaker D. Long's perspective. She always used to say that the governor proposes and the legislature disposes, and so as you start that disposal process, I appreciate the opportunity to offer a few thoughts. I have a much shorter list than Peter, but I'll run through those. As you know, it's the role of a finance commissioner and former finance commissioners to dampen enthusiasm and expectations, and so I'd like to start with just a couple cautions. First of all, I think it's important to recognize that the $2.2 billion surplus is really not newfound money that you can use to start new programs or make permanent tax cuts. It's $1 billion of one-time money and another billion that's just enough to cover inflation. As you know, Minnesota is the only state in the country that counts inflation in the revenue forecast but ignores it in the spending forecast. So my first advice is to give serious consideration to correcting that. I think it's important that you know the numbers you're dealing with. Whether you choose to fund or not fund those is a policy decision, but I think it's important to start with good information. So if we're going to assume inflation in the prices and incomes to generate more sales and income taxes, then we also need to recognize the reality that teachers and firefighters will get raises and that the price of asphalt will go up. Once you fix that process, it'll be obvious that the first $1 billion of the surplus is money in the bank. The second billion is just enough to cover the cost of the programs you already have in place. There's nothing new to pay for programs over and above inflation. I think it's useful, and I'd encourage you to think of the surplus as two separate billion-dollar pots of money. The first is what's projected to be available in the next 5 months, the remainder of the biennium that we're currently in. That's real money. When the forecast update comes out, it's unlikely to change very much. It's going to be about $1 billion. But it's a one-time windfall. And it's a cardinal rule of financial management that one-time money should only be used for one-time things. That's so we don't make commitments that we cannot afford tomorrow. It means that the first $1 billion cannot be used to restore past program cuts or permanently reduce taxes. If you do either of those things, then you're going to be creating another budget gap in the next biennium. Here are three possibilities, and obviously there are more, but these are three that I suggest you think about in how to use that first $1 billion. First of all, you have the option of giving some of it back in the form of one-time rebates. If you do, I think it's important to recognize that it's one-time Jesse checks, or Kim checks, or whoever, Margaret checks, or whatever you end up doing with that. But it's I thought that was timely to mention that. But it's not permanent rate reductions or permanent property tax release, because it's one-time money. Once you use it, it's not available for the next year. Second option is to squirrel some of that away for the next rainy day. We draw down reserves when we have recessions, but then we restore reserves when the economy recovers. The current reserve is around 3.5% of the biennial budget. It'd be nice to get it a little closer to 5%, which is kind of the standard that's often used. Finally, and this is what I'd encourage you to think most seriously about, is using some of it to buy some reform. A lot of different possibilities there. The one I'd really encourage you to think about is things that will get us off the revenue roller coaster. One of my other partners in crime, Jay Kudrowski, wrote an interesting op-ed piece not too long ago about the roller coaster that we're on in Minnesota. During good times, we have, as another one of my predecessors, my successors said, was that we had boatloads of money. Pam Blelock talked about when we had the economic good times. But then when the recessions hit, the bottom falls out of our revenues in the state. And so we swing between these times of plenty when we make commitments that we can't afford over the long term, and then we plunge ourselves into crises when the economy slows. Different ways to stabilize that. In fact, the state economists and state demographer, the Tom and Tom show is the most popular show in town now, I think, at least for wants, is they're talking about different ways to do that. One way to do that is to broaden the sales tax base to include more goods and services. You don't have to increase taxes by doing that. You can lower the tax rate and decide what that part of government should be that Peter was talking about. And tax credits can be used to offset impacts that you might not want to have on lower income citizens. This is that's the first, the billion. The second billion, and here's the way I'd encourage you to think about that second $1 billion that's projected, a little more tentative because we're projecting out farther. It's into the next biennium, but I wouldn't suspect that the February update is going to make a major change in those numbers. Remember that it's not new money that can be used to start new programs automatically or to permanently cut taxes. It's just enough to continue to pay for the current commitments we already have. And here's the key. It doesn't mean you have to do that. It doesn't mean that you have to automatically pay for inflation. It doesn't mean you have to automatically fund all those same programs. And that's kind of what Peter was talking about. You always have the option of changing the way that extra $1 billion is allocated. We are going to spend another $1 billion in the next biennium, unless you decide to give some of it back, lower the tax rates, shift the allocations on all that. But all things going forward, there is going to be another $1 billion. Here's three possibilities that I encourage you to consider. First, think about restoring some of the past cuts that are going to cost us more in the long run. Invest some of that second $1 billion in programs that will generate future cost savings. And the ones that are obvious are things like early childhood education and health care for kids. Art Rolnick has done a good job of articulating that, the return on that kind of investment. Next possibility is tackle the real cost drivers in the budget. The things that we tend to spend our most focus our most attention on tend to be the easy things, the things that are easier to fix. The harder things are those that are going to cause us more problems over the next decade and two decades. And that's the 2020 challenge that a lot of people are talking about now. In fact, there was an article in the paper this morning on the front page. The year we're going to have more seniors than children. That those of us that are grayer in this room are the first wave of the baby boom, and we're going to be the burden on our children. We have to start containing the burgeoning costs of long-term care. And we can do that, I think, by using some of that $1 billion to try to leverage some investments in the private sector, try to do some government things that encourage things like new insurance and investment products that encourage people to invest more on their own and take the personal responsibility to do that. Invest in services and technologies that are going to allow us to care for people in their own home, where they want to be anyway, and where it's more cost-effective to do that, and then preserve the safety net for those that truly need that for long-term care. And finally, the third thing I'd encourage you to think about is targeting the funding, the allocations to the people that really need it. A lot of talk about property tax and tuition increases, obviously, as a result of the recent decisions. We do need, I think, to provide more relief to moderate-income homeowners, renters, and students. And I think it's important to think about how to provide that aid directly to them. Here's what I mean. If you look at all the money that we put into property tax relief, only about a fourth of that is income-based through the Circuit Breaker program. That delivers aid directly to the people who need it most, the people who can't afford it. The cuts to local government aid do need to be restored. I mean, those have definitely had an impact. But I think it's also important to recognize that program helps property taxpayers, all property taxpayers in the cities that get LGA, including the millionaires on Summit Avenue. It does nothing for the lower and moderate income taxpayers in communities that don't receive local government aid. It might surprise you to learn that half of the taxpayers in my city, the city I manage, qualify for the circuit breaker. Half of the taxpayers in my city are low and moderate income taxpayers, and they qualify for the circuit breaker. And they'll get no relief from local government aid restorations because we get no local government aid, and shouldn't. I serve a community that doesn't need local government aid. We have a good tax base. But I'd encourage you to think about, as you address the property tax relief, is to think about those programs that more directly deliver aid to people that need it. I think the same thing's true for college tuition relief. Less than 15%, somewhere between 10 and 15% of all the money we put into higher education is in income-based student aid. Obviously, when we provide more funding to the U of N and MSCU, that will hold down tuition growth. But it does so for everything, everyone. It does so for students that can afford to go to any college in the country. If we want to make a bigger impact than those that are being priced out of colleges, I encourage you to think about putting a significant share of any increase into student aid. That's basically all my remarks, and I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity. I think the easiest route is always just to add back things that have been cut in the past. And I'd really encourage you to resist that temptation and think about putting the money where you think it'll do the most good. We have a good opportunity to do that, as Peter mentioned, with the surplus. And I think we can still use that to position Minnesota to be stronger in the future. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? We have about 5 minutes. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Considering that I'd like to react to your introductory comments about what was available and not counting inflation and so on, your continuous use of the word surplus, and Mr. Hutchinson also used the word surplus. How would you define a surplus in light of your comments and Mr. Hutchinson's earlier?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, I think the best way to think of a surplus is the difference between ongoing revenue and ongoing spending. And if you look at the first the conclusion of this biennium in 5 months, there is another $1 billion. That clearly is a surplus. That's the one-time money I was talking about. I think looking at the next biennium, I think it's important to start from the perspective of having the inflation in both sides, which basically says that there is no surplus. We're starting from that premise. We're balanced, but we don't have money over and above the forecast. But then I also went on to emphasize that it doesn't mean that you have to automatically fund all that inflation. You can make decisions for if you're going to put money into higher education. Part of that money that's the inflationary money that goes into higher education, you can choose to do that in different ways or not fully fund it. That's one thing we did when I was roaming the halls here is we funded different programs at different amounts. Just because you start with the number, know where you start from, I think we can make better decisions about how then to allocate those funds.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Cool. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are, in fact, can do the same thing from the other side, not recognize inflation and fund those that we think need the inflationary increases, rather than fund everything inflationary and cut back those. It's kind of a six of one, half a dozen the other. We do have some inflation built into our quite a bit, $1 billion worth, if I remember the figures that the governor has been talking about. I don't know where if he's going to recognize any of that in his budget, but we already have $1 billion of inflation. I would call it inflation built into our next biennium.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, you're correct. Some programs do have inflation, entitlement programs in particular have inflation built into some of those programs. What I was suggesting is that we start from sort of an apples-to-apples number and then make decisions from that point on. The danger is what I think Mr. Hutchinson talked about is that people claim that they were cut if they don't receive the full amount of what that inflationary funding is. In one sense, they're right that we cannot continue the programs as they have been. In other words, the cost of just continuing those programs with no change would be that. But I think that's then the challenge, is to challenge them to make changes. And also make decisions about how it's allocated. You're going to have another $1 billion in the next biennium, unless you do something with the revenue side of it. That's a great opportunity to decide how to allocate that, not just automatically put it into all the programs that have been there in the past.
Just a point of information, I think, Representative Earhart, there are some inflationary things built into the forecast on health and human services issues mostly, but most of that money that is in inflation, or what we would call the automatic, is not necessarily inflation as much as it is youth enrollment entitlement to increase numbers that qualify for some of those particular issues. And some of that's a relationship as well with the federal government to programs as well. So we have majority of that is in health care. It was interesting with both Peter Hutchinson and John Gagnus that the theme is kind of looking at the reality of how we're going out. And if we look at Mr. Hutchinson's projections and the federal government projections, our challenges are obviously going to be mainly in the area of health care costs. And if anybody's got any big magic bullets on that, let me know. I know that Representative Huntley had another commitment, and he had said he wanted to really be here for both the presentations. So he may be asking you for some additional advice on those as well. Any other questions of these two witnesses? I really want to thank you, Mr. Ganyu and Mr. Hutchinson. Peter, you were kind of had a short notice for this meeting. We appreciate you coming over for that as well.
Thanks
for having me. Mary Liz has a question. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, my question is not to either one of the speakers, but to you, actually.
Sure.
We are wondering when we will receive some type of narrative explaining the difference between finance and ways and means, and the minority is also looking for some type of delineation of the responsibility of the various committees. We've seen nothing in writing, and through different conversations with Republican leads on different committees, there's less than clarity in discussing with committee chairs exactly what the jurisdictions of the various committees in the past. There's been a written document that has laid that out, and in the minority we are looking for that information, and we have the speaker here and the majority leader, and so we're asking some kind of timeline to be able to have answers to those questions.
I think that's a reasonable request, and I can give you a little bit of a response right now, but maybe the best thing would be to do it afterwards, since we're kind of running out of time.
That's fine. I guess we're just looking for something in writing that we can rely on as we put bills together. Certainly, you know, strategically, it might be better to put bills into two separate bills to avoid some type of multiplication of committees that a bill would have to go through. And
that's a very reasonable request, and we'll
respond to that. And we're in the first week of session and looking for that information.
Respond to that very quickly. Margaret, did you?
Well, I think that Representative Holbrook raises a good question. I think that generally what you can look at is that the Finance Committee has the overall jurisdiction over the spending bills, and any realignment of accounts or anything like that will happen, and any amendments probably happen in the Finance Committee. This committee's overall charge is to do overall state budget policy, as well as the budget resolution and the targets. And so bills will travel through this committee to be certified, a more truer meaning of ways and means, in terms of the original purpose of this committee in the House to certify those bills. You'll have, I think, as the rules move along, as well as in terms of accounts and where things are at very soon, a clear understanding of that. The most important thing for all members to know is that your work should be done in committee. It should not be done in Ways and Means or in the Finance Committee or dependent on that. You should be a full participant in your committees, because that's where the bulk of the work will be done.
Does that help?
Mr. Chair, certainly that helps, but some written document that delineates the different spending and policy areas and where they fall within the committee structure would be very helpful.
We'll try to get
minority.
That to you in, as soon as possible.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Also in your packets, I wanted to announce that the rules are there. Rules that, you know, I just do not have any, to tell you the truth. But again, if there's some reaction to the rules that we've established, let me know and we can make some changes on it. Any other questions before the group? If not, the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you for coming.